Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday. Elizabeth Rosenthal is with us again today. She has been writing such an important series on healthcare for the New York Times. And as she told us the last time she's been here, they've just been getting thousands and thousands and thousands of responses to the articles. The series is titled Paying Till It Hurts. And last Sunday, the front page story was Patients' Costs Skyrocket, Specialists' Incomes Soar. Elizabeth was named science editor for the Times in 2003. She was a correspondent for the China Bureau for a number of years. The piece starts with the story of Kim Little's tiny white spot on the side of her cheek. It was basal cell carcinoma, the removal of which wound up costing $1,833 for Mohs surgery, $14,407 for the plastic surgeon, $1,000 for the anesthesiologist, and $8,774 for hospital charges. Elizabeth writes, Ms. Little's seemingly minor medical problem, she had the least dangerous form of skin cancer, racked up big bills because it involved three doctors from specialties that are among the highest compensated in medicine, and it was done on the grounds of a hospital. And there are all kinds of sub-stories. Actually, they're not sub-stories. They're all major stories in themselves. With so many specialists, what's happening to primary care physicians? And how does all of this add to the cost of health care in this country, which is now, get this, this country has a $2.7 trillion medical bill. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Elizabeth. We always get many of them when she's on. 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. Email is talk at WPR.org. And our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Hi, Elizabeth. Thanks for being with us again.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, I just want to tell you again how important your series is, and I know you've been getting phenomenal response to it, but every time you read this, you think, I sure am glad you're writing these stories because I don't think we know all of this.
Well, it was certainly a surprise to me, and I, trained in medicine 20 years ago, so I thought I'd seen it all, but every time I start one of these stories, I learn that it's really worse than I thought, even.
Yeah. Well, let's start, as you do, in the story with Kim Little's basal cell carcinoma, and how in the world it wound up costing this phenomenal amount of money.
Well, you know, there's a lot of choice in how you treat any condition, and the choice in our system often gravitates towards the most expensive mix of doctors and location, and that's what she got. You know, she had a little basal cell carcinoma that some doctors have told me they could have scraped off, they could have used cream to treat, but she got the $64,000 treatment. Not literally, it was literally about $20,000.
Yeah, amazing. I've had several of those taken off, and I've never even heard of this kind of surgery that was done on her, and it was done in the office. You know, insurance paid for most of it, but this was incredibly expensive for something I've had done at least three times.
Yes, and I think the reason this procedure and this specialty is in kind of Medicare's crosshairs at the moment is that the use of Mohs surgery has increased something like 400% in the last 10 years. And this is an old technique. It was invented in the 1930s. Yes, there's more skin cancer, but Mohs is not the only treatment for skin cancer. And so you got to wonder what's driving this huge rise in its use.
Mm-hmm.
And it's partially finances, at least.
Yeah. And you list the kind of specialists who are making quite a bit of money. Dermatologists are doing very well, aren't they, right now?
Yes, and that was somewhat surprising to me because 20 years ago, they were kind of average earners.
Mm-hmm.
But when you look at the income trajectories of different specialties, as I said in the story, some specialties have been very, very expert at monetizing what they do. They figured out ways to generate good incomes from relatively minor procedures.
And how do they do that? How do they generate that kind of money?
Well, you know, the thing you always hear from the internists and the primary care doctors generally is the way we compensate doctors for healthcare is we value procedures very highly. So if you do something, even if that doing something takes 15 seconds, that's valued very highly. Whereas if you think for half an hour trying to figure out why someone's in heart failure, reimbursement for that isn't so good. So if you can find a procedure as a specialist, it's like finding gold because you can just do it over and over and over again and you can bill for it. We essentially think of all procedures as surgery, whereas in fact, you know, there's a big difference between having heart bypass surgery and having a wart frozen off your foot, but they're both billed as surgery.
Yeah. Some of those surgeries, those more minor ones you even write in the article, are passed off to assistants.
This has been a way that a number of specialists and general doctors, too, have been able to expand their revenue, which is to hire what are called physician extenders. So they'll hire a physician assistant or a nurse practitioner who works on their behalf, and they don't even really have to be in the room or in the office. So there are essentially three of them doing procedures at the same time. So it can be very lucrative. Now, you know, I want to be clear that Mohs surgery used in the appropriate case is really wonderful. If you've got a basal cell carcinoma in a very delicate area, like on the tip of your nose or on the eyelid, or a certain kind of basal cell carcinoma, you know, some dermatologists have pointed out to me it can really be, it can prevent disfigurement. It's really great. And likewise, there are a lot of doctors out there who aren't doing this procedure thing, who are not profiting from this, who are kind of offended that their specialty is getting kind of tarred because some of these doctors are just kind of cranking out the procedures to make money.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not everyone. It's like everything. It's
right.
Used, there are appropriate uses and inappropriate uses.
But inappropriate uses certainly add to the cost of healthcare in this country.
Yes, and in certain procedures like this one and in colonoscopies, they're pretty rampant from what I hear from doctors. So the inappropriate uses may even outweigh the appropriate ones.
You mentioned certain specialists, and let's talk about those, the specialists that appear at the top of physician earners and how these specialists, and some are counterintuitive. You wouldn't think they would be making the most money, how they're making their money.
At the top of the list, you always find anesthesiologists, dermatologists, radiologists, gastroenterologists, as well as the ones who you intuitively would think are making a lot of money, like the heart surgeons and the neurosurgeons, who, you know, go through those latter two, they go through 10 plus years of training. They're waking up in the middle of the night. They are really they devote decades to training. But some of the other highly compensated specialties, you know, again, it's just that they figured out a way to monetize the services they provide well.
Yeah. They also, tell me about this practice, maybe investing in some of the equipment that they're using, or they have an interest in these ambulatory surgery centers.
Yeah, this surprised me, too. I mean, some of the highest paid specialties, it's not that they're getting so much from their doctoring. It's that they've become investors. So, for example, if I'm an orthopedist, maybe I own the physical therapy practice I refer to, or maybe I own the MRI scan or the ambulatory surgery suite. So in some specialties, doctors are actually earning more from these investments than from actually being a doctor. And again, the doctors who are trying to make a living from doctoring get really hurt by this because Medicare's response is to say, oh, you know, we know all you guys are making money by investing, so we're going to cut back your reimbursement for actually doing the surgery. So if you're a surgeon who's just trying to get by doing your surgery, you may be having trouble right now.
Really, Medicare looks at all of those outside things going on, huh?
Yeah, they try to, but, you know, it's a kind of cat and mouse game. For example, when a lot of colonoscopies move to surgery centers, they decrease the reimbursement for the gastroenterologist who does it and added a facility fee for the surgery center. Mm-hmm. But, you know, what if you're the gastroenterologist who doesn't own a surgery center?
Right.
You just get that decreased reimbursement. So in many ways, it's hurting the doctors who are trying to be the most efficient.
We've talked before, and you've written before, about the salaries that the executives of hospitals make in this country. So if you're a doctor and you're making $400,000, you know, they would say, well, what the heck? My boss, the head of this hospital, is making well over $1 million, maybe $2 million. I deserve $500,000.
Yeah, and I'm not unsympathetic to that argument. You know, there's so much waste in our healthcare system, and I do think that's a lot of what drives this feeling of entitlement among physicians, that they say, look, I trained really hard, I'm expert, and there are 10 people at my hospital who are kind of business guys who are making over $1 million a year. So don't look at me cross-eyed because I'm making $300,000. So, and then, you know, likewise, the hospital executives will say, well, yeah, you know, I know you don't like me making $1 million, but look at the CEO of Cigna or Aetna. They're making over $50 million. So it's become this like inflationary cycle where everyone wants more because they're looking around and they see that there's all this money in our system and much of it is wasted. But if it's going to be wasted, everyone wants some of it themselves.
One of the statistics that you cite, Elizabeth, really was just dumbfounding to me. And that's how the effect all of this has on the number of people who go into primary care medicine, which is what we need in this country. It is so small. People would be astounded, I think.
Yeah, it's very disturbing because obviously for things like accountable care organizations and medical homes, some of the backbone in innovations of the Affordable Care Act to work, you need a lot of primary care doctors. And not many people are going into that these days because they look around. And I've talked to a number of them in the last few days. And it's not so much, they'll say, look, no one is starving, no doctor is starving. But it's really demeaning and discouraging to see someone who's just like me, who didn't train any harder than me, be a, you know, for example, a dermatologist, have this nice lifestyle, take off a handful of lesions a day and get paid not 20% more than me, but 3 times more than me. That just hurts.
Mm-hmm. You also did comparisons with other countries, and that's another thing that's astounding. And I think that you cited Germany.
Yep. Well, yeah, I mean, you know, what you find in other countries is that specialists make somewhat more than primary care doctors. In our country, it tends to be 2 to 4 times more. You also see that most other countries have about maybe a third to a half of doctors are primary care doctors. In our country, it's much, much less than that. You know, again, everything is just in Germany. I use just by way of comparison because they're a country that sets reasonable prices, they think. It's not a socialized system. But, you know, for a biopsy or some of the skin procedures that we talk about, they would charge maybe $50. And in this country, it would be 10 times as much.
Yeah. We welcome phone calls for Elizabeth. Our lines are already filled. We have one opening right now on our lines. Elizabeth Rosenthal is our guest. She has another in her series, important series, Pain Till It Hurts, in the New York Times last Sunday. Patients' costs skyrocket, specialists' incomes soar. We're interested in hearing from all of you, be you a patient or be you a doctor, a specialist. We'd be interested in hearing from you or a primary care doctor. And those of you who have experience with other healthcare systems as well. Well, just about everybody can call in, of course. 800-486-8655 is the number. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter @KDunnShow. Elizabeth is a science editor for The New York Times. She also is a medical doctor. She's one of those people who, when you think about a life really well-lived and filled with all kinds of specialties, she's at the top of the list of people who can do just that. Spent a lot of time reporting from China as well on important health issues. So we'll go to you momentarily. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now for Elizabeth Rosenthal and start with Dagmar in Madison. Hi, Dagmar.
Oh, hello.
Hi.
Yeah, you know, am I on the radio?
Yes, you are.
Okay. Yes, you know, my brother in Germany is a surgeon, and he said that doctors in Germany only pay a few hundred dollars malpractice insurance rates. And I saw Howard Dean 2 years ago on C-SPAN. He said he and his wife are both doctors, and they have to pay such gigantic malpractice insurance rates, often six figures, that at that point it would cost $12,000 for every single American. And we had lost our health insurance for years. I'm now on Medicare, so I researched this carefully. And recently there was a Harvard professor on PBS. He said that we are spending half as much as the entire world combined on our health care. So there are many things involved, you know, doctors, lawyers, malpractice, insurance, all that. We have to get them all together. Otherwise, we'll never solve this problem.
Mm. Address the malpractice issue, please, Elizabeth.
Yeah, that's certainly true. We have a big problem with malpractice rates here and malpractice suits, and that is certainly something that's driving up cost. I would, you know, just like to point out to listeners, though, that the specialties that have the very high malpractice rates are not generally the very highly compensated ones. I think OBGYNs have the highest malpractice rate, and they're kind of average earners, and they're up in the middle of the night a lot.
Right.
On the other hand, dermatologists don't have very high malpractice rates. You know, that's an average. So, you know, malpractice rates can range from $20,000 to $200,000, depending on your specialty and the part of the country. Now, there's no question that that's high. It's a burden for doctors, as is medical school tuition. You know, big financial burden. So when doctors come out of medical school and try and decide what they want to do with their life, boy, if they're $200,000 in debt, that's certainly going to color what they choose, rather than, you know, they may be thinking about that more than about what kind of mission they want to fulfill or wanted to fulfill before they started medical school.
So it's a lot less expensive in other countries. Elizabeth, do you have comparisons?
I don't have exact comparisons, but in many other countries, it's state-supported, so it's free. You know, if you go into the U.S. military, it's free, but there's a commitment to serve. So, you know, I want to make the point in this series that it really isn't one thing. It's not just doctor's fees. Malpractice is a part of it. Medical education is a part of it. Hospital fees, our insurance system. It's a system that's deeply dysfunctional that we like to say is a market, but it's a very poorly functioning market if we want a market-based system.
Thanks, Dagmar. Let's go to Jack in Madison. Hi, Jack.
Hi. You kind of just stole my thunder about that whole point about medical costs. But as a medical student currently in my last year, I want to point out that you have to give credit to every doctor, whether they're OB-GYN or dermatology or plastic surgery. Anyone who has an MD went through all 4 years, and on top of that, you have your undergrad education. A lot of us have invested a lot more than 8 to 12 years of our lives just to get into residency.
Mm-hmm.
And going through that, you end up moving around, going away from your family for a number of years. There's a lot that we've all sacrificed to get to where we want to get to. And the issue isn't just the amount of sacrifice, but also that financial burden. Our country, relative to other countries, I'm going around interviewing, and I see lots of actually foreign grads from India and Pakistan, and I ask them, and I talk to them, and they have zero costs in terms of debt, where their countries pay for their entire medical education. And granted, we have the best education and we have the highest technology and the most cutting-edge technologies in terms of medicine, but you have to also take into account that every doctor has gone gone through a considerable number of years in training, and we've invested a lot of our time, and we've also obviously got a huge debt that we've got to pay back, and a lot of that, you have to look back at that system in terms of the debt and how much we owe and we're paying.
Does that influence, as you're about to graduate here, does that determine in some ways, because you have to pay back the debt, your choice of medicine, that you'll go into something that will pay more?
You know, for me personally, it hasn't. Even though I'm close to $300,000 in debt, it has. But I know a lot of my classmates, and it has. And for me, maybe in the future, it will. And once I have a family, once I get married, once I'm going to have some sort of greater cost in my life, that's certainly probably going to be something that's going to take its toll. And you've got to keep all of these things into account and think about those things when.
Yeah, Elizabeth.
Yeah, I certainly think it's true. You know, I went to medical school, but it was 25 years ago, and it wasn't nearly as expensive. And I think the incredible debt that people are facing is really something we have to come to terms with, too. You know, like I said, it's not one. It's a system that is inherently inflationary from the very day you walk into medical school. So maybe we need to think about some kind of service. We pay for your medical school, and you devote a certain number of years to primary care or service to an in-need area. We've experimented with those ideas before, but we've really never undertaken them as a system.
How is this? It isn't directly related to your article, but it really got me wondering about primary care physicians. And as we've talked about how crucial they are to the Affordable Care Act and to all of our lives, if you only have 12% of doctors going into primary care, there must be a real shortage of primary care doctors in this country.
Well, there is, but because of the way we tend to use medicine, a lot of people, if they have something wrong with their stomach, they go right to a gastroenterologist. Uh-huh. If they have, so we go right to a dermatologist, even if a primary care doctor might be able to solve that. So that is part of the problem, and a lot of the primary care doctors are older. Those slots are not being filled. So we're really going to, some of that need could be met more by nurse practitioners probably, but in a lot of states there are restrictions on what they can do. So we really need to rethink how we do primary care, as well as, again, it's the system. It's not, one bad guy. It's a system which we have let move in a direction, and the labor force which we've let move in a direction that is not what we say we want. Mm-hmm. So we better do something about it.
Thanks, Jack, for your call. John in Rhinelander, hello.
Hi there. I know that there are an awful lot of lobbyists that serve the interests of doctors. They have associations, and healthcare corporations have their own, and Big Pharma has its own. I'm wondering, are there any lobbyists that speak for us, the patients, to try and get at some of these glaring problems, like, a skin procedure costs 10 times here what it costs in Germany? It seems the problems would be real easy to solve if our legislators had the guts to step in and do something. I think they're not even hearing from us patients.
I agree. That's a big part of why we started this series, because really there are some voices speaking up for patients. I mean, there's Consumer Reports, Consumers Union. There are a number of smaller healthcare groups. They are not a match for the, I think it's $60 million last year spent lobbying by medical professionals. And what you find is that the specialists that are most highly paid have the highest lobbying budget. So lobbying works. And I think one of the reasons we've had such a great response to this series, now we were trying to tally, I think it's over 20,000 comments, is because people don't have a place to put this frustration right now. Mm-hmm. They're angry. The system is not serving them well. And it's not on a ballot where you can check a box saying, I don't like, you know, this cost seems outrageous. What do? You trust your doctor, who's mostly telling you what he or she thinks is the right thing. And you're in a very vulnerable position. So you figure out a way to pay it or work out a payment plan or, you know, you struggle. And I think people are really frustrated and at their wit's end. And that's why we're hearing from so many people.
Mm. And why is it, do you think, Elizabeth, we struggled so long for health care reform in this country and we're still fighting over it? But why don't we have a really thorough investigation, which you're doing now as a reporter for the New York Times? God bless you for doing it. But where's Congress on this issue? Where are people who are looking seriously at how to bring down the cost?
Well, there are a lot of people thinking about this. And, you know, in our country, for better and worse, you have to balance what's politically possible with what's what you need. And unfortunately, at the moment, part of the compromise that the Obama administration made for the Affordable Care Act was to do away with, for example, bargaining on drug pricing. I mean, every other country does that, but we're not allowed to. Some of the ideas in the Affordable Care Act, like the medical homes and the accountable care organizations, are pushing costs down, but, you know, in a very direct, indirect, and a very slow way. And I guess the question for Congress and the question for patients, if they want to become more activists on this issue, is how do we demand more control over prices and more transparency over prices? Because, you know, if you look at those explanation of benefits, if you're insured, you're going to be outraged. These prices are really high, even if you don't know how much people are paying in Germany or Switzerland or right. England or France. You know, and P.S., as we all face higher deductible plans now, we're going to be paying a lot more of that out of pocket, too. So it really behooves everyone to kind of start screaming, I think.
Thanks, John, for the call. Dr. Roy, Two Rivers.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, Helen.
It's Helen?
I'm a 65-year-old primary care doctor, and I started practicing back in the 70s. And what I noticed after my first 10 years of practice was that my patients actually became less healthy the more I did what is the standard practice of care. And our largest health care cost are due to the fact that we do not have a system that is oriented towards improving the health of our patients. We have a system that is oriented towards treating symptoms with pharmaceutical drugs. And once I changed my practice and dedicated myself to actually doing what helps patients become healthy, I found that my patients became very healthy and their costs became less. They hardly had to see me after a few years.
What did you tell them to do, doctor?
Well, the most important things for people's health are people have a foundation. There is a foundation for health. If the foundation is present, we will get healthier over time. If we ignore our foundations of health, we become more ill. And our nation has ignored the foundations of health, and instead we pay for the problems that that causes. The foundations for health, the basic foundations, are number one, we have to eat pure, healthy food that is grown on farms, free of chemicals, hopefully close to your home so you really know how it's done. We have to eat those foods in ways that are wise. We could go in more to that. The second thing is we have to have a clean and healthy environment. We have to have pure food, pure air, pure water, and non-toxic homes free of chemical pollution and electromagnetic pollution and radiation. We do all of those things, people become much healthier. Probably 80% of our health problems are due to ignoring those two steps that has nothing to do with health care.
Thank you, Dr. Roy. Elizabeth.
Yeah, well, one of the problems with our system, of course, is that when doctors spend time advising their patients on, you know, how to live healthier, that isn't reimbursed very well. You know, you can spend an hour, and I've spoken to a number of primary care doctors in the past few days in response to this story and for another one that's coming up. You know, a good primary care doctor is learning about your family, learning about your exercise habits, learning how much you drink, learning what your diet is like. But that's not, no one pays for that. And then they have to record that all. You know, that isn't paid very well, but if you do a procedure or if you send them off for blood tests and x-rays, that's paid pretty well. That's paid really well. So, you know, the incentives are all wrong to encourage good primary care. And that's one of the things last year or in May, the National Commission on Physician Payment Reform came out with its report. And it concluded we really have to incentivize payment to physicians very differently. And there are a lot of people thinking about how that should be done. But in a way, it's a question of political will. It's not rocket science what kinds of things we need to do.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for the call. Tom in Cedarburg. Hello.
Hi, Kathleen. I'd like to point out, I heard a show on NPR a few months ago that was talking about the cost of health care. And one of the main issues that they brought up was the people who run and own the hospitals and clinics. These are, many of them are not doctors. They're a business people. Some are doctors, but they make way, way, way too much money. I mean, like $3 or $4 million a year. And it's no wonder that, you know, to have a procedure done, you know, that a pill costs, you know, $10 or, you know, for aspirin or, you know, something like that. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the key things, other than the things you brought up, which I value also, but this is one of the key reasons that it's so expensive. Even though they're maybe considered to be nonprofit, they're really not.
Elizabeth, you've written about this.
Yes, most hospitals are nonprofit, but that doesn't mean they're not profitable. They're very profitable. They just don't pay money to investors. What they do is they take the money they earn and they pay very good salaries, increasingly great salaries over time. They invest in amenities such as all private rooms, coffee shops, nice gift shops, spas. Yes, there's an incredible amount of money that's invested in things that are not essential to healthcare. Now, that being said, I would say that if we kind of put our money where our mouths are on this, we may be a little surprised, because you may go to a hospital that's a really cost-efficient hospital with not high-paid execs, and you might find it seems a little kind of bare bones compared to what we're used to. Mm-hmm. You know, but it will provide great health care. So, you know, the problem is that for us as consumers is that things we see aren't really what matter in healthcare. They're the kinds of hotel amenities that people go, oh, wow, I like that they have coffee in the lobby. Well, that's great. But is that worth having a $10,000 colonoscopy that's bankrupting our country? No, of course not.
Right. Let's go back to Ms. Little for just a moment, who had this skin cancer. She was an informed consumer. I mean, she read about this. What role do we have as consumers of healthcare? Could she not have said to the doctor, you know, who was going to use this Mohs surgery, listen, I think that what I've got is this basal cell carcinoma. It's not the most serious kind of cancer. Can't you just freeze this off or whatever in your office?
Yes, she could have, but this was her, you know, her first basal cell carcinoma, I believe. Other people have written to me and said, you know, I did that Mohs surgery once, and the next time I said, I want the cream. And you're going to have to push for that. And I think it depends partly on your personality. It depends how you respond when someone says, oh, it could be cancer. We are not used to questioning doctors, and we're also not used to asking about price. And I think when people say, what can I do as an individual, you know, while I'm waiting for healthcare reform and system changes, and the thing I say, which is hard because we're not used to it, is to question, ask for prices. You know, it's going to be uncomfortable because, as many people said in response to a question on this last story, often when you ask for a price, the doctor will say, oh, go to the billing office, I don't know, or look at you like, isn't your health worth it?
Oh.
And I think we have to get over that because, it, you know, if particularly as we're paying out of pocket, we're going to start having to say, no, you know, this is not about what's worth it. This is about what's good for me.
More phone calls in a moment. Elizabeth Rosenthal, our guest this hour, her series for the New York Times, Paying Till It Hurts, had another installment last Sunday. Patients' costs skyrocket, specialists' incomes soar. Our phone number, one line is open, 800-486-8655. I'll also, if you want to send, if you can't get through and you want to send an email, I'll read those for you. And here's how you do it, talk@WPR.org. You can also leave messages for our reading pleasure and on the air possibly at The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we go to more phone calls. Dave in Appleton, hi.
Hi. I just think it's impossible to deputize people to become experts in their own medical care. Otherwise, we'd all be doctors. And then it's also impossible to have the same conversation when employers pay for most people's health care in this country, and people have no idea what their employer pays. And when Medicare is very efficiently taking care of our seniors, unless we're all on the same page, having the same conversation and feeling the same pain of the inefficiencies of our system, we're never going to get there. Obamacare caused a lot of conversation, but the people who are lambasting it, we're doing so when they didn't have to face the problems that our system has because they were protected by an employer or by Medicare. We can't do it unless we have national health care. We're all on the same page, all paying out of our own taxes to do it.
Elizabeth.
Yes, that is certainly one of the things I was referring to when I said what was politically possible. You know, for better and worse, the Medicare for all option or a single payer plan or a national health system was from pretty much day one off the table when we were talking about Obamacare. And I think, you know, that is certainly something I'm hearing more about, not just from patients, but from doctors who say what we really need is a single payer system. And certainly in many, many other countries, that's what allows price control, that allows for direct comparison. And it also makes it impossible for a hospital or a doctor to say, oh, we don't know what it's going to cost because it depends on your employer, it depends on your insurer, it depends on this negotiation. No, you know, there's a price list and you know exactly what it's going to cost. So, yes, that's one solution that solves the problem, but it's regarded as politically not viable in this country. And I'd like to see a poll, actually, whether Americans think it's a good idea or not. I haven't seen that.
Mm. Thank you so much, Dave, for the call. Bob in Wauwatosa.
Hello.
Hi, Bob.
I have a question I'd like to pose in the form of a statement addressing a large Wisconsin corporation that has been taking over local and regional practices, and their ad on the radio and on television uses the phrase, "Is your doctor an Aurora doctor?" I think this goes to the heart of the problem, and I'd like your guests to comment on the takeover of physician practices by big corporations, and I'll hang up and listen.
All right, Bob, thanks.
Now, this is a hard one. I think what I would say, yes, we're seeing this in many, many parts of the country, that hospitals are increasingly buying up physician practices. The physicians then become a hospital employees. And what happens next really depends on the motivation for that system. I mean, if you are in a multi-system group where the goal was to increase efficiency and coordinate care, that can happen. But often this is done as a financial kind of a tactic to corner the market. And the doctors, once they're part of the hospital, are encouraged to order tests at the hospital's x-ray facility, to do blood tests at the hospital's labs. And so, you know, I think the smartest comment I heard in this year of covering healthcare was the outcome of consolidation depends on what the goal was. If the goal was to make more money, which it often is, that will happen. If the goal is to make a more efficient system, that will happen. So, and I think we're seeing a lot more consolidation based on the desire for financial gain than for good medical care at the moment. But each case is different.
Dee on email said she's driven to tears in frustration with every medical bill she receives. No one can tell her going in to see a doctor how much the fee will be. We moved to central Wisconsin for a simpler life, and we found medical costs at least a third more than in the Milwaukee metro area, where she used to get a discount for paying her bill. After moving here, I was told the base rate of $159 was for a single-issue visit, and if I were to bring up secondary issues, it would cost more, but not even the billing department could tell me what to expect, and no discounts. Doctors tell me they have no idea how much it costs to see them.
Yeah, this is a big problem, and I think this is where, you know, we're being given this really mixed message. Everyone says, oh, be a better consumer of healthcare, but, you know, try it, and you run up against one brick wall after another. You know, I went to medical school. I practiced medicine briefly. I'm as informed a consumer as I think you can get, and I look open, you know, my explanation of benefits, and I'm just like, what on earth is that? Mm. And I ask for treatment costs, and you can't get them. If you ask too much, you're kind of labeled a difficult patient. Like, why do you care? You have insurance. And I think, you know, we need such a radical redesign of the whole attitude. In many countries, prices are up in doctors' offices. In hospitals, they're priceless. Huh. I guess I failed to see why we can't have some version. And I know hospitals will say, you know, look, every insurer is different. We negotiate discounts. Those rates, our rack rates, don't reflect what's actually paid. And I feel like, fine, you know, at hotels, the rack rates don't reflect what's actually paid, but we require them to be listed anyway. So I would like to see every hospital have to put up their rates, and then at least you could start the discussion. But we're not there yet.
Just as you were saying that, I was just imagining that happening. Can you imagine going into a hospital or doctor's office and here are our rates? Oh, my gosh.
Right.
What a radical idea.
Right. And, you know, you see from your explanation of benefits that often what's actually paid by your insurer is 20% of that. But I think, you know, then the question becomes, so why do you have these crazy rates on bills if you know you're going to take 20% in the end? We wouldn't want to do that kind of bargaining on a car or on a kitchen renovation. Why would we do it with something that's as important as our health care?
Yeah. Lynn in Rice Lake.
Yes.
Hi.
Hi, I've been listening to your program, and I am wondering if your author, or never mind, read the article in the Atlantic Monthly from July, August 2013 that tells about the cartel that meets three times a year to decide what Medicare should pay them and their colleagues for the medical procedures they perform. And if they're doing that for Medicare, certainly it's going to affect all the other aspects.
I assume you're talking. I don't remember that exact article, but I assume they're talking about the. I think it's called the. It has a very long acronym. The Relative Value Scale Update Committee. It's called the RUC. Of the American Medical Association, in which all the specialists and primary care people get together in a room and try and thrash out, you know, who should get what part of the Medicare pie. Mm-hmm. And Medicare typically takes those recommendations, not 100%, but nearly so. And, you know, since they all know that Medicare isn't going to up the fee, they are fighting each other for those health care dollars. That committee is very heavily weighted towards specialists, towards proceduralists. So the primary care docs feel they get the short shrift there. There's a part of our latest article about that. And again, a lot of people think that whole method of setting fees really has to change, because many, many insurers use Medicare as a yardstick, not as an absolute number, but they'll say Medicare pays $100, we're going to pay 150% of Medicare rates. So that scale, that relative value scale, kind of dictates what's valued and what's not.
Thank you, Lynn, for your call. Ed is next. Hi, Ed.
Hello.
Hi. Yeah,
thanks for taking my call.
All right.
And I would like to tell the journalist, thank you for your efforts. My point is that when we say insurance will pay for it, we need to remember that insurance is us. We are actually paying for it. And it seems way too convenient for people to always say, well, insurance is paying for it. And our whole nation needs to start to wake up that we are the insurance, and we are being gouged by them, by the hospitals, and by healthcare in general. And we are so ripe for, as you mentioned before, a single payer system that we need to think anew. And that's my comment.
Thanks, Ed.
It always amuses me when people respond to things that were in the Affordable Care Act, and they say, oh, isn't it great that, you know, women's annual women's health exhibit visits are free. And I'm like, whoa, they're not free. You don't pay anything for them. But this nothing here is free. And I think in some ways, and the slight light at the end of the tunnel here is that the advent of these higher deductible policies, so less and less is perceived as free. I'm paying 20% of it, and I'm going to, you know, pay attention if that bill is $3,000, because 20% is going to add up. But still, you know, this notion that anything is free or covered by insurance. You know, I've had these interactions with doctors where they'll say, oh, we're going to X-ray your whole leg because your ankle hurts. And I'll say, I just need my ankle X-rayed. And they'll say, well, but you have good insurance. Why do you care? And I care.
Yes, of course.
And I think everyone should be opening those insurance statements, and everyone should be squawking if those numbers are high, even if, you know, quote unquote, your insurance is paying and it's free to you, because next year those rates are going to mean you pay higher premiums.
Right. Yeah, good point. Michael in Madison.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure, Michael.
I'm an emergency physician, actually, in the Madison area, and I was just responding to one of Elizabeth's comments and some of the callers about a single-payer system. I think that a lot of physicians, in general, are in favor of the idea behind a single-payer, but we have two primary reservations about it, and one being that we don't want, our practice dictated to us by a government entity, what we refer to as kind of cookbook medicine. And secondarily, we're fearful of what reimbursement will look like if we have just one payer. And for instance, in the state of Wisconsin, when we see Medicaid patients in the emergency department, the highest level of care I can provide is only reimbursed $37.
Elizabeth, we have about a minute left.
These are real fears. I guess the question in the end for physicians as well as patients is, if physicians are part of a for-profit or profit-making group, their decisions are going to be somewhat constrained by that group that's going to want them to order more tests to make more money. And the reimbursement issue is real. I mean, you know, Medicaid pays much less than it costs to take care of people. On the other hand, Medicare maybe is at about the right level. But we're certainly wasting so much money in other ways that we could think of fair reimbursements, I hope, that would satisfy both physicians and their patients.
Yeah. Not that, I mean, I know you just finished a series, but how long does the series go on, Elizabeth?
We're not sure. I know there's at least two more pieces.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's been a wonderful series because many of the pieces come in response to comments that to the previous piece. So it's kind of self-propelling.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's so valuable, too. And you've been thanked for before from listeners, but what you've done such a valuable service. So I think you should just keep writing them forever. That's
well, I hope it's going to change so I won't have to keep writing them forever.
Gotcha. Thanks, Elizabeth, very much.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Elizabeth Rosenthal, her series for the New York Times is Paying Till It Hurts. And last Sunday, she had a front page story on patients' costs skyrocket, specialists' income soar. She talked about, and she'll have more than this number by the end of today, I'm sure. They've already had 20,000 comments on this series. That's a lot of comments. So it points to a need for a deeper understanding and probably for some changes in the whole system. All right. Thanks to K.P. Whaley for producing this hour. And thanks to K.P. Whaley for on-air production in our studios here. We're in downtown Milwaukee. News is coming up from National Public Radio and then Central Time. So there will be great conversations ahead. Judith Sears-Poisson will join you Monday for all things political and other programs. Thanks for listening.